recorded live 1966 with the Muddy Waters Blues Band. That was Big Mama Thornton and Sometimes I Have a Heartache. Plus we heard from Little Hat Jones. That was Corpus Blues from Texas. We're going to play a few more pre-war tunes, older blues here for the next little bit. We're going to start with Blind Willie McTell. Here he is with the Death Cell Blues. Blind Willie McTell on the Deep Blues Hour.
Chained down in a death cell by myself. Chained in a death cell by myself. And my gal, she guess she got somebody else. Well, they've got me accused for murder, and I haven't even harmed a man. They got me accused for murder, I haven't even harmed a man. Oh, they got me charged with burglary, and I haven't even raised my hand.
Hi, you're listening to
WRCT
Pittsburgh, CMU. This is Sue Garner
and Rick Brown.
Have some barbecue sauce.
So part of me wishes I had something positive and inspiring to start with on what could be such a beautiful holiday week here in the United States, Thanksgiving coming up later this week. Unfortunately, I don't. I have something potentially very negative, but one of the things that I've always said I want to do on this program is I don't want to go overboard with hyperbole about something being bad. But I also don't want to understate when something is potentially not looking good. Let's accurately evaluate how 2022 and subsequently 2024 is looking for Democrats and for the left, to the extent that the left is functioning or operating within the Democratic Party at this time. And unfortunately, Democrats are facing a historic, disastrous defeat in 2022, above and beyond even what is typical in the first midterm after a different party has grabbed the White House. Our friend, multiple-time former guest on the show, political scientist Rachel Bitticoffer, is sort of sounding the alarm on this and saying, listen, it doesn't have to be that bad for Democrats in 2022. But Democrats need a plan, which is currently completely lacking. So we're going to talk about that. But at this point, I'm comfortable telling you that if we accurately evaluate all of the factors at our disposal right now, 2022 could be a complete and total disaster for Democrats, the likes of which Democrats don't recover from for multiple election cycles. And then we add to that, as we mentioned last week, that aside from flipping seats, fighting races, on redistricting alone, Democrats could lose a handful of seats in the House of Representatives. So I encourage people to kind of just set the stage for this. Read the article by Chauncey DeVega in Salon, which we're linking to on YouTube, by Rachel Bitticoffer, about what 2022 could be looking like. Rachel Bitticoffer is very, very scared about what's going on. And Chauncey accurately kind of gives us a number of the important points here, of course, with the November election results of a couple of weeks ago as one data point. The reality that Democrats don't really seem to have a strategy right now other than to continue running on "we're not Trump." And of course, Trump is gone, and that did not work very well in Virginia. And there's a great conversation with Rachel Bitticoffer here, where she is asked, what are the errors being made by Democrats? And she says, first, understand the following about the outcome in Virginia. A year before, basically on the night of the 2020 election, when it was clear Biden had won, the enthusiasm advantage for Republicans was predictable. Republicans were going to be out of power, which meant they were going to get enthusiastic and engaged, and they are. As stupid as this whole Let's Go Brandon thing is, it's working as an engagement rallying cry for the sort of dumb right, as we might call it. Rachel goes on to say Democrats were going to be in power, which meant Democratic voters were going to tune out and participate less. That seems to be happening. Where that vote was going to disappear was always predictable. The Democratic coalition ebbs and flows in terms of turnout. Some of those voters are going to be Democrats, others independents who tend to vote Democrats. Certain demographics where this ends to happen tends to happen in terms of turnout, such as younger voters and minorities. The Democrats know where they need to focus. You build an infrastructure around the weakest parts of the coalition, not from the top down, but the bottom up. Even with all of this knowledge ahead of time, the Democrats are not running elections using that information or redesigning how they run election campaigns to build on the realities of the electorate and the impact of polarization and hyperpartisanship. Meanwhile, Republicans are running a fine-tuned machine right now. Watching the Democrats and Terry McAuliffe's team was basically like watching somebody perform algebra without having multiplication as a skill set. It's not about just saying, hey, Youngkin is like Trump. It's about making an association. Youngkin is like Trump. Trump is the Republican Party. The Republican Party is Trump. This matters to you. Why? Because it's going to impact you negatively. This is a key part. What the Republicans did with critical race theory was package it through the emotion about parental control over education. They used it as a proxy. It's not really about critical race theory, because remember, critical race theory is not even being taught in Virginia. It's a stand-in for a challenge in white privilege and whether white parents want their kids to feel guilty for being white. It doesn't matter if a random Republican can define what CRT is. Remember, they can't. He knows what it means. The Republicans knew what that man would know when they used the language. Critical race theory means we're going to protect you from having to feel guilty about being white and for your kids having to feel guilty for being white, for having your white hegemonic power challenged in this more diverse America. Now, there's other stuff in this article about are Democrats bad at politics? Not really our subject for discussion here. I don't believe this is hyperbolic from Rachel Bitticoffer. And I also think this is such a unique situation with such a huge potential for disaster that the risk is asymmetrical. And so the strategy has to be asymmetrical as well. What do I mean by that? Some of you who have had like basic stats know about expected value, right? If I tell you flip a coin and if it's heads, you get nothing. And if it's tails, you get $100. Mathematically, the expected value of that flip is $50. But there's no outcome where you actually get $50. You either get zero or 100, but statistically you have an expected value of $50. If you have a 10-sided die that you roll and the outcomes are, if you roll a one, you get a dollar. If you roll a four, you get $4, right? The expected value for the average roll is five, even though the reality is you might get one, you might get 10. Now with this 2022-2024 stuff, even if the outcome of total blowout disaster for Democrats is only 10%. It would be so disastrous that you need to go above and beyond the expected value thought process. When you look at it and you say, well, I should assign as much effort to preventing the 1 out of 10 scenario or the 1 out of 20 scenario based on its mathematical likelihood, you're understating how disastrous it would be. It would be such a disaster for Republicans to do as well as Rachel points out that you actually need to over-prepare for it because the risk is asymmetric or asymmetrical. And I think Rachel Bitticoffer is rightly sounding the alarm on that. We're going to delve much deeper early in 22 into Senate, House, and governorships. But those who are understating and saying, well, you know, New Jersey governorship was no big deal because oftentimes Democrats just straight up lose and Phil Murphy won, even if by a little bit. So that's not that bad. And it's not looking that bad in the House. There's a scenario that's coming together, which is maybe not the predominant scenario, but it's a plausible scenario that is potentially a 10-year disaster for Democrats and for the left in the United States. And I think it's a good thing that people like Rachel Bitticoffer are sounding the alarm on it. Over the weekend, we started to see not only the protests as a result of the full not guilty verdicts for Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We also started to see COVID protests turn violent around the world. Now, you might say, David, what, are people protesting the virus? No, no, no. What I mean is protests around COVID guidelines. Many countries starting to put in place stricter guidelines for the unvaccinated as cases are spiking dramatically in many countries in Europe, including Germany, Austria, and others. And the protests against guidelines, against vaccine requirements, are turning increasingly violent. I'm going to give you a little bit of a tour through some of these. Dutch police arrest seven amid unrest in The Hague. Police arrested seven rioters in The Hague after youths set fire in the streets and threw fireworks at officers. The unrest came a day after police opened fire on protesters in Rotterdam. Amidst violence that broke out at a protest against coronavirus restrictions. That's in The Hague. The rioting in The Hague was on a smaller scale than the pitched battles on the streets of Rotterdam, where police say three rioters were hit by bullets and investigations are underway to figure out if they were shot by police. In Austria, Italy, and Croatia, protests erupt over virus rules. Tens of thousands of protesters, many from far-right groups, marched through Vienna, Austria on Saturday after this nationwide lockdown was announced. Austrian lockdown starts today, comes as average daily deaths have tripled. Hospitals in heavily hit states are reaching capacity. Lockdown will be at least 10 days, could be 20. This continuing in so many different parts of the world. In Italy, 3,000 turned out in the capital Circus Maximus, where in ancient times, Romans would have popular entertainment, to protest green pass certificates required to go to workplaces, restaurants, cinemas, theaters, sports venues, and gyms, and long-distance train, bus, and ferry travel. In Northern Ireland, people opposed to vaccine passports protested outside the city hall in Belfast. Some protesters carried signs that have been widely criticized as offensive, comparing coronavirus restrictions to the actions of Nazi Germany. In Croatia, thousands have gathered. In France, there have been violent protesters. In France, they have been condemning violent protests in the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe, one of France's overseas territories, where cars have been set on fire. Tens of thousands protest Belgium's tighter COVID-19 rules. You see police fire hoses brought out to try to quell protests. Tens of thousands demonstrating there. Marchers came to protest the government's strong advice to get vaccinated and any possible moves to impose mandatory shots, shouting freedom, 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 and singing the anti-fascist song Bella Ciao. Protesters lined up behind a banner that says Together for Freedom. Dutch police arrest more than 30 amid ongoing unrest. Already looked at one article of that. They are describing an orgy of violence. Interesting language. And France has sent special forces to the Caribbean region of Guadeloupe over COVID riots. What is the end game here? Because it is increasingly looking like there are going to be ebbs and flows of COVID for at least a couple more years. Now, there is the hope, based on Israeli data, that the third dose creates more lasting immunity than the initial set or regimen of two doses. And of course, if that's the case, if people get vaccinated, we may see a more permanent decline in COVID rates and particularly hospitalizations and deaths. But at this point, it's pretty clear, based on the level of interest in getting vaccinated in a variety of countries, which is too low, that at least for a couple of years, while we hopefully wait, as Vincent Racaniello told us may happen, for a decline in the severity of COVID, as we wait for that, that there is going to be a very long period of time of the ebbs and flows. So what do we do? Do we learn to sort of live with it? Do we say, well, you've got to just continue with a sort of semi-restricted way of life for a couple of years? Do you go to let it rip at a certain point, as many have suggested, saying, well, once the vaccines are widely available for everyone, it becomes personal responsibility. There's problems with that. I don't have the answer. But what's increasingly clear is, number one, to the extent that there are guidelines, there are going to be people protesting, and hopefully not, but worryingly, in increasingly violent fashion, number one. And number two, this is not going away anytime soon. And so I don't know the answer. We're going to be doing an interview next week, I think it is, related to the kind of bigger picture at this point in time. But I'm curious to hear from you. What should happen, given that this is likely to be the case for years? And I know people who are saying, I don't know that I'm ever going to a restaurant again. Okay, that's certainly one approach. But self-selecting out of life has its own problems, not to quote Donald Trump. But over the long term, obviously, that's going to create a problem as well. What should be done at this point? Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman, and we'll have a continuing conversation about this. So we are going to be doing another one of our great viewer town halls. This next one has been scheduled for December 14th. We're going to do it at 6 p.m. Eastern time. It will be streaming live on the second YouTube channel, the Pacman Live YouTube channel, which you can find at youtube.com/PacmanLive. I think we took something like 60 or 70 different calls from viewers on the last one. And of course, members will get priority during the town hall. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. I encourage you to do so. All right, this is really beyond belief. Donald Trump has written a book. Written is not actually the right word, and it is literally a picture book. you know all those jokes about Trump's executive orders are written in crayon, Trump's presidential library would be pictures of tweets, and then like the not jokes, like for example, Trump's presidential daily briefing was a single page, double-spaced, mostly pictures and charts. That was true. Trump has done what many former presidents do, which is he made a book, not wrote a book, made a book, but it is a literal picture book with pictures and descriptions of the pictures written apparently by Trump, which read like his old tweets. You just have to see this. Donald Trump Jr. tweeting about it, excited, saying, huge news, a new book by President Donald Trump is being published coming out next month, Our Journey Together, a beautiful 300 plus page color, coffee table style. Read all about it. Guys, it's a picture book. The Washington Examiner writes about it, and they include some pictures from the book, I guess you would say. And like, for example, I'm describing this to our audio audience. There's a picture of Trump sitting in the Oval Office with Nancy Pelosi. And the caption, which I get, it's really the writing. It says, attempting to listen to crazy Nancy Pelosi in the Oval Office. Such natural disagreement. Many presidents write books. Trump has done a picture book with captions that are insults of people. Another picture, this is the picture that we now know was a staged picture from the White House. I believe it's the Situation Room. We know that this picture was staged. And it says, the night we got Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, we destroyed ISIS under my watch. Now terrorists are back in the Middle East. So this one's in it. This picture is an insult of Joe Biden. We since learned this picture was staged. Trump was actually, I believe, playing golf at the relevant time. One more example, Trump sitting alongside German Chancellor Angela Merkel and then British Prime Minister Theresa May. And the caption is an insult to Theresa May, where Trump wrote, meeting with German Chancellor and British Prime Minister, Theresa tried hard but didn't get the job done. Boris Johnson is much better for the United Kingdom. And then just like kind of family pictures of different kinds. You really couldn't write this stuff, guys. I mean, this is, it's, we talk about Trump being sort of semi-literate in the sense that we know he hasn't read a book in decades, at least maybe in his entire adult life. We know that his writing was very strange and compromised. And so even in doing what just about every president does, writing a book, it's a picture book with the equivalent of his tweets insulting people. And of course, to sell it, they say it's a coffee table style book. It's a picture book, guys. It's absolutely insane. And even more maybe pathetic is that this picture book got Trump an interview on Fox News, which is what I want to talk about next. So Donald Trump was interviewed about his book, if you can believe it. The interviewer is Fox News's Mark Levin. The main question should be, sir, why is this a picture book? Most presidents write a real book. Why did you decide to do a picture book? Now, the reality is, if Trump wrote a book, it would be very obvious he didn't write it, because Trump can't write in any way that would lead to a book. Trump's previous books were written by ghostwriters. Tony Schwartz was one of those ghostwriters. He's talked about how Trump doesn't read, Trump doesn't write. It's all a humiliating, pathetic thing. Okay, so Trump's interviewed about the book. The entire interview is a humiliating farce. This is an interview that even for Trump, is particularly riddled with lies. So Trump opens the interview with multiple lies about gas prices. Let's start there. See, make it a game. See if you can count the number of lies.
We weren't leaving $85 billion behind. We weren't leaving 10 cents behind. I said every bolt, every screw, every nail comes out. And all of these things, it was a beautiful period. I was under assault, like no president has ever been.
And sorry, this is not even actually the right clip. Let's start with the gas price clip. I apologize.
Gasoline was $1.87. That was a year ago. And now it's, I guess, just hit $7.50 in California, the rest to follow. And I predicted this.
Okay. So let go through that line by, let's look at everything Trump said. Trump says he predicted this. Listen, everyone predicted that when demand goes back up, as the pandemic eases, gas prices will go up. Everybody predicted it. That's not unique. Number two, Trump says a year ago, gas was $1.87. That's a lie. A year ago, the national average for gasoline was $2.20. Now you could say, well, it was still lower than now. Yeah, but it wasn't $1.87. It was $2.20. And then Trump says gas is $7.50 in California. Now, is it possible that there's a gas station in California selling super premium for $7.50? It's possible. The gas price in California officially right now is $3.38. You don't compare $1.87 or actually $2.20 to what you can find for super premium at one gas station. We compare actual official numbers. California gas is $3.38. A year ago, it was $2.20 nationally. We have to compare to official numbers. I'm sorry, California is at $4.70. And that's the number that it's not $7.50, it's $4.70. The official price now nationally is $3.38. And this is called cherry picking of data. It's lies all the way down. He's lying about everything. Okay, then Trump talking about how great a period it was when he was president. Just everybody was happy. Russia was happy. Everybody was happy.
I don't think any president has ever been under assault like this. And one thing after another, phony impeachments. I call it the impeachment hoax number one, the impeachment hoax number two, the Mueller thing, although it worked out good, but it took 2.5 years and it made it very difficult to deal with.
Remember, Trump still falsely claims that the Mueller report exonerated him on obstruction of justice, which it didn't do. It's like ancient history at this point, but just he's still lying about it.
In countries, in particular Russia, you know, we could have done some great things with Russia. Very good for our country, for our country, also good for Russia.
Right.
But you couldn't do that because they would have said, oh, he loves Russia. These people are sick.
So Trump continuing to kind of rewrite history sort of in the same way. He also, and this is one of my favorite things, Trump talks about how much he and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un liked each other. Remember this infamous rally speech where Trump said, he wrote me beautiful letters and then we fell in love. Trump going back and telling his stories about Kim Jong-un during this very strange interview.
Ended up in a war. That's the biggest problem we had. So I became, you know, We did very well with Kim Jong-un, and we liked each other.
Now, remember, we liked each other. Okay. I mean, we know Trump is sort of smitten by dictators. We didn't really do well with Kim Jong-un in the sense that Kim Jong-un made the same vague promises to Trump that North Korean dictators have been making to global leaders for a very long time. They didn't do any of the stuff. And in fact, remember that Trump just walked away from the second meeting because it was going nowhere predictably. So Trump didn't really do anything with Kim Jong-un.
A terrible thing to say. We like to, I'll get criticized. Oh, he likes Kim Jong-un. Well, that's what we have. And I did. I got along with him great. He got along with me great. After a very rough start, if you remember Little Rocket Man and the buttons, he said, we have a red button and we'll use it. I said, no, our button is bigger than yours and our button works. And it was nasty. And then all of a sudden, it ended and all of that stopped.
And what's funny is it ended in Kim Jong-un didn't do any of the stuff he promised to do, and Trump just stopped talking about it. It's actually very funny. Trump wants you to believe it ended in some kind of geopolitical success. It ended where Trump just bailed on the second summit. North Korea didn't stick to any of the promises, and it was never mentioned again as a foreign policy goal. Okay, then Trump going back to the lies about the 1918 flu, which he still calls the 1917 flu, and is still confused about it.
All over the world. So in 1917, as you know, we had the Spanish flu, it was called, and it possibly killed as many as 100 million people. You know, I don't know if you read the history of the Spanish flu, but you probably, I think you read about everything, come to think of it. But it probably was a thing that was most responsible for ending World War I.
Because all the soldiers
were sick, and many were dying. The Spanish flu was devastating, and they say up to 100 million people died. And it probably did end World War I, but 100 million people.
Okay. Again, you can't even keep up with the lies. It was the 1918 flu, not 1917. We've looked up and down. We interviewed a Spanish flu historian and said who told us there's no reason at all anyone would call it the 1917 flu, number one. Number two, it did not end World War I. That is not true. Trump keeps repeating it. It is not true. Now, Trump says it might have killed 100 million people. The consensus death toll for the Spanish flu is considered 17 to 50 million. And there's a sort of, it could be as high as 100 million because we don't have great data from some other countries. But the important thing is Trump's trying to use it to minimize COVID. In the U.S., the Spanish flu death toll is believed to be 675,000. We now have almost 800,000 deaths from COVID. So COVID is already more deadly in the U.S. than the 1918 flu pandemic. It's all lies all the time. Do you think that the average Fox viewer realizes the number of lies that are being told here? I think the answer is no. Trump then pulls out the communism talking points.
Number one, I love our country, and our country is based on the Constitution. And you know, our country is not living up to the Constitution right now with the kind of things you see. They're trying to subvert it.
Now, importantly, if Mark Levin was an actual interviewer, he would have said, sir, why is your book a picture book? Okay, I already mentioned that. He would have said, why do you keep calling it the 1917 flu? Nobody says that that's the right name for it. It's the 1918 flu. Why are you lying about gas prices? That's not true. But when the Constitution stuff comes up, a real interviewer would say, exactly which aspect of the Constitution or Bill of Rights are they subverting? And who is they? Tell me exactly. It's not asked. And Mark Levin, who claims to be an expert on the Constitution, just allows it to happen.
And more so now than anybody would ever believe. Bernie Sanders is saying, I can't believe they're doing this. This is far more than what they're doing to our country. Is perhaps, you know, they talk socialism, this is communism. And so
now it's not communism. There's no communism here. There's been no government takeover of businesses. And there's just not communism here.
In many ways, there's no freedom of the press. The press is totally corrupt. The press and them are the same. There's no freedom of the press. That's how communism starts.
Now, those are literally all lies. And Mark Levin does nothing to push back against it. Trump then tries to say he did a really great job on COVID. Really, really good job.
but I built him a hospital. I sent in the hospital ship. I built hospitals in Louisiana. I built hospitals all over. All over. Portable hospitals, thousands of beds. We did a phenomenal job, except when it came to public relations, because no matter what we did, the press would not cover it fairly. So we did a fantastic job.
Yeah. We now know that thanks to Trump's inaction and delayed response, and for months not talking about masks and saying 15 cases would soon go to zero, those decisions, people were going to die. People were going to die. There's no doubt about it. But tens of thousands of needless deaths simply from Trump's slow action. Okay, wrapping this up, Trump actually talking about the book, and he talks about, you know, his picture book. It's just humiliating.
Anyway, yeah. At a meeting filled with individuals, what was that all about?
Well, I have a number of pictures, and I have a picture of Nancy Pelosi. I have a picture of Merkel.
I mean, guys, this is the most childish thing. Most presidents write a book. Trump is talking about the pictures that he put in the book.
I got along with very well. That was a pointer also. We have a lot of pointers. You know, there are a lot of people pointing. But with Pelosi.
Okay. So there it is. And then lastly, here is Trump saying something unintelligible about gasoline once again.
I don't think people see it that way. They knew that they got gasoline for X dollars a tank. And now they can multiply it times four, and they're saying, what's happened?
Okay, and of course, gasoline prices have not multiplied themselves by four, and Trump telling lie after lie. So the missing question really is, why did you write a picture book? Most presidents choose to write they write. You chose a picture book. That's interesting, sir. Tell us why. That question not asked, and a completely bizarre, humiliating interview with the former president. We're going to take a quick break. Make sure you're following us on Instagram at David Pakman Show, and we'll have much more coming up. All right, this is super interesting. You guys may remember we've been covering this incredible double standard, this incredible hypocrisy, where Fox News hosts and many in right-wing media have been slamming the Joe Biden vaccine mandate protocol requirement, in which large employers with more than 100 employees have to either get their employees vaccinated, get proof that their employees are vaccinated, or they have to test their unvaccinated employees once a week. Now, Fox News has implemented a much stricter protocol where you either need to be vaccinated or test daily, and you're required to wear a mask when working on location in certain areas. So the Fox protocol, the Fox requirement, the Fox guidelines, call it whatever you want, it is stricter than the ones outlined by Joe Biden. Another Fox host was confronted about this. This is really interesting. This is Pete Hegseth, who's a big anti-Biden guy, big bomb thrower. And he was interviewed by Mediaite's editor-in-chief Aidan McLaughlin. And when he was confronted with this double standard, where Hegseth is regularly railing on the Biden protocol, but Fox's, his employer's protocol is stricter, he first wasn't really sure what to say. Then he resorted to attacking Mediaite, which might not surprise you. Let's take a look at this. Very instructive.
There was a vaccine or test requirement at the Patriot Awards, which is very similar to the policy at Fox News. Do you have an issue with Fox News having a policy like that, which is effectively the same as Biden's vaccine mandate for big businesses?
You're not mandated to get the vaccine because you can get a test.
Right. Now, remember, it's the same thing with Joe Biden. You're not mandated to get the vaccine because you can get a test.
I'm not in charge of it. I don't make the calls, but either you have the option to get a test, so you're not. It's not actually a complete vaccine mandate, and that's fine. I mean, it's not my call. So I'm grateful for the people that provide us this opportunity, and the show went off without a hitch.
Right, but it's just that, you know, Joe Biden's vaccine mandate for big businesses has been the subject of criticism. And that's even less stringent than the one at Fox News, right? It requires weekly testing as opposed to daily testing. So I'm curious as to why you have an issue with the Joe Biden vaccine mandate,
right,
but no problem with the one at Fox News.
Beautiful.
What do you want me to say?
Well, answer the question. Say, for example, I'm doing it to get clicks, or it's our editorial position and it's totally hypocritical. Or like, what he wants you to say is answer the question, Pete.
I mean, ultimately, companies have prerogatives. What the government shouldn't be doing is telling them what to do. The government shouldn't be telling them what to do. every company has its own policies, and I'm beyond grateful for the opportunity to work at the Fox News Channel. And it does things that no other organization does, including your organization, Mediaite.
So now he just goes into attacking the interviewer.
It's part of the trash heap of left-wing media that, you know, does the same thing everyone else does. That's why we're number one. I mean, I can't even imagine what the clicks are on your site. Is it like 15 people a day, like only journalists in New York 16. City that click on your, that click, 16, good. They're the only people that read Mediaite. The
does actual that include you,
people
Pete?
read the Fox News Channel. So you guys want to nitpick and do your thing. It's cool. But
it's funny to say it's nitpicking to point out that Fox News has been waging a propaganda war against Biden's vaccine mandate while having a stricter mandate for its own employees. Pete Hegseth calls that nitpicking.
I could not be more grateful for the Fox News.
Okay, so there it is. So he eventually comes across something that sounds kind of like an explanation, which is, hey, listen, I'm fine with private companies doing what they think is best, but they shouldn't be told by the government that that's what they had to do. But in getting to that explanation, he first has to attack Mediaite to get there and insult them and say, you guys only get 15 clicks. And this is actually very common. Remember when Tucker Carlson was confronted with the same thing, his reaction was just as bizarre.
Okay, so I have a question here about Fox News.
Yeah.
You said Fox News has no vaccine mandate. But according to Newsweek, the company requires unvaccinated employees to submit to daily COVID testing, which is stricter than Biden's mandate, which calls for weekly testing
right.
for businesses that employ more than 100 people. Is Fox News denying the civil liberties of its employees by being stricter than President Biden?
Fair question.
I don't know. I mean, you should probably ask Newsweek. It sounds like they got a pretty precise handle on what's happening.
If it's wrong, let me know. If I'm wrong.
It's completely wrong, as I noted the other night. I'm not, you know.
So what is the policy? Can you tell us the policy?
I'm not qualified to speak for the company on this because I don't run the company and I'm not, you know, I'm just an employee.
Now, that's very disingenuous. Tucker could just speak to his experience with the policy as an employee. He doesn't have to speak on it as an employer. It's very disingenuous.
Company. My personal preference is that Fox News would, you know, make a statement about what its policies are. But I think like a lot of companies, you know, they're hesitant to do that because like, why would you even want to get involved in that conversation? Here's the bottom line. You know, there are a lot of infectious diseases out there, a lot, and a lot with much higher mortality rates than COVID-19. And, you know, there's HIV.
Yeah. So then as a reminder, he goes into kind of comparing and equating COVID vaccination and COVID to HIV, which is, of course, an insane analogy given that HIV is sexually transmitted. You can't sneeze on someone and give them HIV. There's no vaccine for HIV. I mean, every time that they are actually confronted with this, it's a fair question every time. They know that they're stuck in an inconsistent position and they either get angry and turn to insults or they do whataboutism. So nice job there by Mediaite's Aidan McLaughlin and Pete Hegseth, looking kind of like a doofus, I must say. Hey, I want to talk about, you know, sometimes we focus on the wrong thing and we miss the forest for the trees. When we talk about a story, it can happen to any of us. And there was an incredible series of videos from New York City in which hundreds of Proud Boys, this right-wing group, committed a crime, an infraction, we can call it, for which black teens in New York City, for lack of a better term, and I saw it happen, you know, but when I was on the subway all the time pre-pandemic, I would see it all the time. Black teens will often get arrested by NYPD for doing something that hundreds of Proud Boys did over the weekend, which is they jumped the turnstiles. They went in through an exit door on the subway and literally nothing happened. I'm going to play this video here for our video audience. And you see that there are just dozens and dozens and multiple videos of these Proud Boys on the New York subway. And someone says it's open. And then you start to see these guys pour in through what is supposed to be an exit door. This is called jumping turnstiles. You're not always literally jumping turnstiles. Very often it was like as I was leaving, I would push open the exit and people would slip in. And you see them here. Now, civil rights attorney and longtime public defender Scott Hechinger tweeted about this and said, "As a public defender, I represented literally hundreds of black men and women accused of doing this. Most literally couldn't afford $2.75 subway fare. The difference between eating and not eating for them. Arrested, caged, forced to plea to the crime of theft of services. But when you're white and proud," right? These Proud Boys, at least in these videos, exclusively white. So is it only a racial issue? No, but there's a big racialized component to this. And the turnstile jumping used as a justification to detain young black men on the New York subway is a story almost as old as the subway itself. For a comparison, we do have video of how New York City police deal with some of these other folks. And we have video we're showing here where you see a group of police officers. They are determined to find the turnstile jumpers. And as we follow the camera, you see multiple officers get on a subway car. And they start, they actually pull out tasers in this case. And they're pushing around one guy believed to have been turnstile jumping. And it's really depressing. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 officers. And a scuffle begins. Anyway, you guys know the story. So this is just another one of these cases where we see it and we say, what is going on here? What is the explanation here? And why are there just dozens and dozens of Proud Boys pouring in the exit door, jumping turnstiles, and everything's very, very calm? You tell me if there's a different explanation. I'm glad to see it. But this is a classic that I witnessed 10 times, I guess, dozen or so times when I was on the subway all the time before the pandemic. Just haven't really been using public transit since the start of the pandemic. But something very much to think about. Interesting, just little tidbit from the Proud Boy protests over the weekend. Let's take a quick break. I do want to talk about Ron DeSantis after this short break and a bunch of other things. Glad you're with me today on this shortened Thanksgiving week. There's a really interesting new report from CNN's Gabby Orr and Steve Contorno about Donald Trump's growing fury, quite frankly, that Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, known to some in the pandemic era as Ron Death Santis, you may remember that. Trump's furious that DeSantis is increasingly popular and increasingly being talked about as an alternative to Donald Trump for 2022. Now, you might recall that back in July at CPAC, they did a straw poll. They do these at all CPACs. And Donald Trump easily won that 2024 straw poll. Trump had 70% of the vote. The only other notable participant was Ron DeSantis with 21% of that straw poll vote. And throughout the pandemic, when Trump was president and Ron DeSantis ignored every COVID guideline, opened the state, I think it was to WWE wrestling and UFC fights very early. Later, DeSantis said, cruise ships, if you want to leave from Florida, you can't require vaccines. Trump loved it. Trump was all about Ron DeSantis, and Trumpists were all about Ron DeSantis. He's great. He's the best. How terrific. Pro-business. He's been doing great things. Okay. But now, as Ron DeSantis has become more popular and is being seen increasingly almost like a more competent version of Donald Trump, all of Trump's terrible ideas, but more competence to actually get them done, Trump is apparently furious. And DeSantis also seems to be realizing, hey, I might be up against Trump in 2024. I need to start distancing as well. Let's take a look at the CNN report about this. And it is very, very interesting, which says people close to both men first noticed the palpable shift in Trump's posture towards DeSantis earlier this year, as enthusiasm for the Florida governor swelled among donors and Republican operatives who praised his laissez-faire response to the COVID pandemic. The more DeSantis's popularity soared, the more obsessed Trump became with receiving credit for his political celebrity. In April, Trump told Fox News DeSantis would certainly be under consideration for VP if he were to launch a campaign in 2024. By October, Trump was demanding he publicly rule out a White House bid of his own. So as recently as last month, Trump was saying, DeSantis needs to come out and say, I won't run. And of course, DeSantis hasn't done that because DeSantis might well be thinking of running. It's not that Trump is complaining about Ron, but he likes to remind Ron and others that he made him, said a person close to Trump, who added Trump has been telling people around him that DeSantis could show more gratitude. A statement to CNN from Trump spokesman Taylor Budowich appeared to confirm Trump's obsession with receiving credit for DeSantis' success. Budowich said the former president's 2020 victory in Florida paved the way for Republicans, including Ron DeSantis, to sweep in 2022, and suggested Trump catapulted DeSantis into the governor's mansion with his endorsement. Though the two remain in regular contact, Trump is increasingly irritated at DeSantis' refusal to publicly dismiss a 2024 bid of his own if the former president decides to run. Two people close to the situation said DeSantis has privately assured Trump he has no intention of challenging him, but they noted Trump won't be fully satisfied until he says so publicly. Though DeSantis previously dismissed 2024 chatter as nonsense, he has avoided taking the unequivocal public vow not to challenge Trump. He has filed to run for re-election in 2022. The best case scenario for the left is that Trump goes full metal jacket against Ron DeSantis. DeSantis then retaliates and it becomes a huge nightmare and it helps Republicans implode. Now, I am the first to admit the country is in serious trouble when a governor, with the deaths of thousands, tens of thousands of innocent Americans from COVID on his hands, is seeing his popularity take off. That bodes really poorly for the United States of America. But you just saw 70 million people vote for a doofus imbecile who killed hundreds of thousands with his sheer incompetence in mishandling the pandemic. So we've been in serious trouble for a while now. They seem to want, to some degree, something like DeSantis. There's a very different direction that the Republican electorate could be going, which is to say, we need a different type of Republican. We need like Mitt Romney. We need Liz Cheney, who, by the way, Liz Cheney voted more than 90% of the time with Trump's position. So it's not like Liz Cheney is some big victory, right? But it would be different for Republicans to say the Trump thing didn't work and we're not going to keep going with it. They seem to want a crazy Trump-like figure that would be more able to do the things that Donald Trump wanted to do but wasn't able to do. And unfortunately, that very well could be Ron DeSantis. Very, very scary stuff. Because the left is so poorly positioned going into 22, like we talked about at the top of the show, we're kind of relegated to this very lame position of having to hope that they fight against themselves, and DeSantis versus Trump could be a really great thing. We had another insane weekend of the conspiracy mind virus that is plaguing the American right wing. It's conspiracies everywhere you look. Let's take a little tour through it. On the Maria Bartiromo program yesterday morning on Fox, Marsha Blackburn showed up, Senator Marsha Blackburn, and claimed that Joe Biden is about to replace Kamala Harris, which the president can't actually do. But Senator Marsha Blackburn doesn't seem to care. And of course, Maria Bartiromo now loves conspiracy theories.
Senator, is there anything you want to say about Kamala Harris? She was given the role of acting president.
By the way, why is there music and why does Maria Bartiromo have to yell over the music? Just a production question.
When Joe Biden got his colonoscopy last week.
Colin.
Yeah. And I think when you look at what she has done, she has failed at every task that she's been given. That's why there are many in the White House who are so frustrated with her. It's going to be interesting to see who they push forward to take her place.
What? And, you know, some people in the comments said, oh, she's referring to in Biden's reelection in 2024. That's not what they mean. Many of them don't even believe Biden's running for reelection. So she's talking about who are they going to replace Kamala with. Then we go to something really bizarre. Steve Bannon appearing on some kind of very strange, it appears to be a Chinese propaganda show. It's not even clear what this is. And pushing vaccine conspiracies about segregation and very, very strange stuff.
Of religion. And so I think that this is very powerful. You see every day with a new federal state. Remember, the new federal state's only a year and a half old. It's only 18 months old. And look as what's happened. Today, we're commemorating the third anniversary of really the rule of law, of the great presentation we had that day at the Pierre Hotel. And look how much power that the Rule of Law Foundation, Rule of Law Society, the whistleblower movement, you've changed history. Right here today, you can hear the protest in this city, and the protest is about anti-vaccine, right? And it's not that people are anti-vax, is that they're vaccine hesitant, right? And the reason they're vaccine hesitant is that the information hasn't been put out about exactly what happened in the Wuhan lab.
What?
What is this virus really about, and why therapeutics, prophylactic therapeutics like hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or all these other attributes and what they can do. And so the whole world right now is questioning whether it's in Europe or in France or in Austria or the United States. There's a big protest here today about American citizens who are American born, right? Who are protesting these overreaching mandates to take.
What on earth is Bannon talking about?
Take your freedom away. So I think if you look at the new federal state and what it's been able to accomplish in 18 months and what the whistleblower movement and what GNews and GTV and particularly the rule of law just in 3 years, remember it was 3 years ago today.
All right. So there's Steve Bannon with more anti-vax propaganda. We also had he's right, there were anti-vaccine protests over the weekend. At one of them, the big meme was about the racism of vaccine requirements. Medical segregation is racist, said a sign. Stop the mandate before it's too late. This is a new, very often the right will do this. They'll turn something on its head. And so they'll spend a decade saying, the claims of racism from the left are bogus. The claims of racism from the left are racist, etc. They'll do that. And then all of a sudden, they'll say, hey, this is racist, something that's not actually racist. Vaccine requirements now are racist. Then we go to Alex Jones once again at this Reawaken America tour, which seems to be going on every single weekend. Here is Alex Jones taking a sort of bizarre kind of rapture, revelation, end times approach now with the religious crowd at this event.
We are literally seeing the book of Revelations begin to come true right in front of us. And this is the most important time in human history since Christ walked the earth.
Yeah. So this is actually, this is getting very common. A lot of these types that you don't always associate with the religious nuttery, we just associate them with the kind of like more agnostic conspiracy nuttery. They are going in the direction of jumping on board with the religious nuttery. And then speaking of which, continuing to see trivialization of the Holocaust at another one of these anti-vax protests, I believe this one in New York City, you see another one of these yellow stars go by. And I'll play that again for our audience. You can see the yellow star kind of near the Penske truck, which says yellow. It's a yellow star that says unvaccinated on it. The continued trivialization of the Holocaust, which is just kind of standard operating procedure at this point for people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others. So every single weekend, it is conspiracy after conspiracy. We had the Sherry Tenpenny video of her saying that vaccinating children is a late-term abortion and that COVID testing is torture. And on and on and on. And it is getting really bad. I don't know what turns this around. I really don't. But it is extraordinarily disturbing. We have a voicemail number that you can call anytime you want. The number is 219-2-DAVID-P. Here is a voicemail. It's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it gets at a very good point, which is if gas prices are thanks to Biden and gas prices are up everywhere, it's all thanks to Biden, right? Take a listen to this.
Good afternoon, Mr. Pacman, sir. I have a question about gas prices. Knowing that obviously the gas prices are Joe Biden's fault, I see that the gas prices have also gone up to about $5 U.S. In Canada.
Wow.
And I'm just trying to figure out what socialist policies that Brandon has implemented into Canada to cause them to have also very expensive gas prices, even higher gas prices than we do here.
Yeah.
Love to hear from you.
Yeah. And of course, the caller makes a good point, which is gas prices are up globally. Why is it Joe Biden's fault again? And you guys know me. I do not play these political games with gas prices, whether it's a Democratic president or a Republican president, and whether gas prices are up or gas prices are down. Go look at my clips from when gas prices were low and Obama was president. I was, other than tongue in cheek, joking around, I was not praising Barack Obama for lowering gas prices. American presidents have very little that they can do. What they can do is if they want to dip into the strategic oil reserve, it is believed that they could pull down gas prices by 18 to 20 cents a gallon, and it would take a period of time for that to happen. But of course, the caller is right. You look around the world and you see the same thing. How is it Joe Biden's fault again? Republicans love, love, love doing the gas price games. It's pathetic, but a lot of people fall for it. Oh, we've got a great bonus show for you today. Finally, Trump's Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, he may be on his way out. And we'll tell you why. Number two, New York City wants to limit the use of various artificial intelligence tools for hiring employees. I'll explain. And we now have the results of that estate tax giveaway that was part of Trump's tax plan back in 2017 that was implemented in 2018. It dramatically reduced IRS revenue from inheritance. It had the exact effect that the very rich wanted it to have. We have the full numbers, and we'll talk about them on today's bonus show. Get access to the bonus show by signing up at joinpacman.com. Remember that on December 14th, 6 p.m. Eastern, we'll be doing the next viewer town hall on the Pacman Live YouTube channel. Make sure you're subscribed to that channel. We will give, of course, priority to our website members, but everybody will be allowed to call in. Everybody will be allowed to call in. So number one, subscribe to the Pacman Live YouTube channel. Number two, if you want a much better shot of getting on with me during our town hall, sign up at joinpacman.com. You also will get access to the bonus show as a member, and we will see you there in mere minutes or right back.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
WRCT Pittsburgh, the last bastion of pulchritude.
Or I'm from creationist crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3,
arr. Is Mark G. of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
This is WRCT. This is WRCT. Come on and stay with us a while. Big 900 on your dial. We'll make your day a great big smile. WRCT.
Ah! Yeah, well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT FM. Keep it locked, Rasta.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Marlon Saunders, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we, Andrew?
We are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are... to crush your enemies.
To see them driven before you.
And to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know? Go Steelers.
It's been a long time since you've touched the hand and the heart of that special someone. You're not alone. This is WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation Service. Stay tuned for more tracks from our radio and record library.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh. Automation is the key. I am Dr. Jazz, PhD.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi, I'm Rob.
And I'm Mary.
From High
Places.
And you're listening to WRCT
88.3 FM. A radio station.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yow.
You're tuned to WRCT Pittsburgh's automation.
Hi, we're the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The year 1619 marks the year that the first Africans were sold into the colony of Virginia. And through this series of essays, we really argue that very little about modern American life has been left untouched by this foundational institution.
Today, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones on her new book, The 1619 Project, based on the groundbreaking New York Times series about the legacy of slavery in the United States. We'll talk about the project as well as right-wing attacks on her and efforts to ban the teaching of the 1619 Project and critical race theory.
I realized that that date was foundational, and yet no one had ever thought to teach us that date. And it really symbolized to me both how long Black people had been in this country, how foundational slavery was to America, and also the power of erasure, about who gets to decide what dates and what stories are important and what dates and what stories get left out.
Nicole Hannah-Jones will join us from her home state of Iowa, where she's taking part in a homecoming event in Waterloo tonight with the high school teacher who first introduced her to the date 1619 as the year a ship carrying enslaved people first arrived in what's now the United States. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A jury in Brunswick, Georgia, is set to determine the fate of three white men charged with hunting down and murdering 25-year-old Black jogger Ahmaud Arbery. Lawyers for the defense made closing arguments Monday. A nearly all-white panel of 12 jurors and three alternates is set to hear a rebuttal from prosecutors today before beginning deliberations. Defense attorney Laura Hogue, who represents Greg Michael, the former police officer, blamed Arbery's own actions for his death, and she drew outrage over these comments.
Turning Ahmaud Arbery into a victim after the choices that he made does not reflect the reality of what brought Ahmaud Arbery to Satilla Shores. In his khaki shorts with no socks to cover his long, dirty toenails.
Hoag's comment drew audible gasps from the courtroom. Ahmaud Arbery's mother, Wanda Cooper Jones, was so upset she got up and briefly left the trial. She later condemned Hoag's remarks.
She described Ahmaud as his long legs and his dirty, long toenails. That was just a beyond rude. Regardless of what kind of toenails he had, what size legs he had, that was still my son. And my son actually was running for his life.
Taken together, Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and William Bryan face 9 counts that could see each of them sentenced to life in prison. In Yemen, the Saudi-led military coalition has launched air raids on the capital, Sana'a, with reports of massive explosions in Sana'a's northern neighborhoods. Saudi officials said they targeted Houthi military sites in retaliation for the rebel group's drone attack Saturday on sites in Saudi Arabia, including a major oil hub in Jeddah. The latest violence comes after thousands of people marched through the streets of Sana'a on Monday, protesting U.S. support for the Saudi-led military coalition.
We, the Yemeni people, took to the streets today to denounce